Welcome to Federal Insights, sponsored by Rancher Government Solutions. Here's today's moderator, Tom Temin.
Software supply chain security is important both as a policy and a way for agencies who use software to operate. Every agency, in other words. For some crucial insight, I check in with the Assistant Director of the Supply Chain and Cyber Directorate at the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, Jeanette McMillan. Well, nice to have you with us, and I want to ask about your job itself. What does it entail, and where do you fit in the hierarchy of the whole national security apparatus?
Well, thank you for that question, Tom. Yeah, we are the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. We are part of the Office of Director of National Intelligence that sits on top of the intelligence community. And basically, we are focused on counterintelligence threats from all spectrums, whether we're talking about your classic espionage, as well as talking about insider threats. And of course, what my directorate does is focus on counterintelligence threats that are vectored through the supply chain. And as we know, the supply chain has got a global focus now, and our foreign adversaries are very well aware of that.
So would it be fair to say that you are concerned with maybe advising the government at large what some of the software supply chain and supply chain issues might be? At the same time, you have to protect your own agency from the supply chain, particularly the software that you're buying for your own use.
Absolutely, Tom. That's exactly what NCSC was designed to do, and my directorate specifically. We are certainly concerned with the supply chain of all critical infrastructure, certainly the supply chain that the IC has to source from as well, and how our foreign adversaries are positioned to make sure that they are executing their capabilities through our supply chain. So it is very daunting situation out there. It is never a dull moment, but we are certainly able to get information out there to federal defenders, to the critical infrastructure, and also the private sector and industry that are supporting those critical missions.
And of course, there are policies, there are directives, there are FAR gambits that are cooking up here. There are executive orders all about the supply chain and supply chain security. If you maybe set that all aside, and we know that's the framework under which everyone is operating, looking at the supply chain, what should a good practice in general look like nowadays for ensuring security in the supply chain? Without software in the supply chain, probably 99% of the problems would go away because there's nothing inherently dangerous in, say, a uniform or, you know, a round for a pistol or something. There's no real cybersecurity risk or much risk at all.
Yes, Tom, our digital infrastructure has certainly broadened the landscape, and the threat landscape right now from cybersecurity in the supply chain is astronomical. So when we take an approach to the software supply chain, especially with supply chain security, we're certainly looking at it from a CI and security lens. And by that, we mean we're not just talking about the vulnerabilities, about the code, about what things can do. There's an exploit, a developer is going to have a really, really bad day. But from a counterintelligence and security perspective, when those things are exploited by our nation state actors, that's when we are certain to make sure that we can get information out there with regards to why that has happened. Most actors that are going into these things through supply chain threat vectors are definitely looking at victim companies, government entities, nonprofit organizations, or even your normal average user. And that average user, all of those organizations, all they want to do is get the attacker out. They do not want to spend any more time with their environment being infiltrated the way that it is being infiltrated. But from an NCSC standpoint, from a CI and security standpoint, we really want to know why that happened, how that software was being used to exploit. What was it that they were trying to get after from the foreign adversary standpoint? Were they after data? Were they after information? Were they after customers, users, or anything that was going to disrupt your mission set? So that's why we ask organizations to take that CI and security approach in addition to getting the threat actor out of their environment and making sure that they are patching those vulnerabilities and mitigating for those risks.
Right. So rather than simply slapping at the bees, you want to get after the hive and take that out at some point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And supply chain security is certainly something that we can use to better inform our organizations, our all federal entities, as well as private industry and academia. But we also want to make sure that we understand how software really works from your users, from your suppliers, as well as your developers, and making sure that software security is paramount for each one of those stakeholders is part of our mission as well.
And I look at software in four basic categories. There is software you simply buy and install. Nobody sends shrink-wrapped packages with CD-ROMs anymore, but you can buy something and have it put on your server, and agencies still do that to some extent. Then there's software as a service, which you're buying, again, a pre-arranged piece of software, but you're getting it online through a cloud. Then there is that which is coded for the agency under a contract. And then increasingly, we're seeing more and more software factories and coding operations in the government itself. Four totally different ways of getting software in. Is there any overarching strategy that can apply to all of these, or do you have to customize your approach to supply chain for the four, you know, purchased software as a service, coded custom, and coded in-house?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a security approach to all of that. And I believe the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, has certainly put together a wonderful framework called the Secure Software Development Framework. And no matter where you're getting your software and needing one of those four buckets, you want to make sure that that software is being developed in a secure environment. And not only that it's operating the way it's intended to, but it's also only received access from those authorized developers, and that those developers understand the security that they need to deliver to you, the end user. That will help everybody, no matter where that software is coming from in all four of those buckets, to ensure that when they plug that software in, when they turn it on, when it's part of their network, when it's properly configured, it operates the way it needs to, but it also operates in a secure manner.
I want to get into that a little bit more, but I just wanted to ask you about something you mentioned a moment ago, and that is understanding the threat vector and also the motivation of the attacker. How do you get to that until they actually encrypt something and send you a ransomware note?
Right. No, that's a very good question. It's basically understanding exactly where you are in your footprint, and whether it's a market thing or whether it's an industry, whether you're dealing with development and software or research and development in terms of critical technologies, whether you're in the healthcare industry, or these areas where we know that direct data information and privacy information is going to be implicated. So it's understanding what your industry is, what your environment is, and understanding how those things can be targets for foreign adversaries.
And the supply chain that you're looking at, the software you're looking at, also has to be, and you can tell me more about this, considered in the context of the dependencies that it brings with it, because it might be invoking databases that are already there or interoperating with software you've already secured, but then basically you have a whole new system.
Absolutely. Software is going to be developed for certain functions. For example, an antivirus software has to be intimately involved in every part of your network in order to detect and remove viruses from that specific network and from those particular coding. A word processing piece of software, not so much. They don't have to be as intimately involved. So when you're picking and choosing your software, you want to make sure that the security goes along with the function, goes along with the criticality, and how you want that piece of software to operate securely in your network.
So somehow you have to bring your risk management framework, popular term, into all of this evaluation.
Absolutely. There's no risk. There's risk everywhere, especially when we're talking about the software supply chain. But what we want to do is make sure that folks know what those risks are, can mitigate and attack those risks accordingly.
It's interesting because, you know, at one time, software suppliers would not reveal their source code that was considered proprietary. Now we're into the era of software bills of material, which, again, is not exactly the source code, but it's basically the structure and skeleton and organs and veins of that software. And so let's maybe talk for a moment about software bills of material, and what do you get when you get an SBOM, an electronic artifact, although I understand there's still even paper versions of them that come through for some programs. But then what does that do for you by itself? What else do you need to make the SBOM effective?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely great. And again, not a panacea, but it is certainly a very good first step. So when you get that list of ingredients or whatever is in that particular software package, you'll know exactly what the developer put into it at that initial stage. Now, that's just a beginning. It is not a panacea. And more importantly, software changes over the life cycle. But if you know what you started with, that's at least an opportunity to understand what is already in the box or out of the box once you put it into your network. But it also helps you with several different areas with regards to ensuring that you can configure the software properly into your network. I liken it to having a recipe, and it calls for eggs and it also calls for melted butter. If you put those two things in at the same time, guess what? You're going to get scrambled eggs. So you're not going to be able to get the cookies or cakes shake you want. So understanding what those ingredients are and how they operate in your specific network is very key. And a software bill of materials certainly helps with that. It will also help with prioritizing vulnerabilities in terms of vulnerability patching and whether or not that's a piece of the vulnerability that you need to patch right away, or maybe that's something that can be patched at a later date and time and not take your network and systems off time to do so. And finally, unfortunately, if you do suffer a cyber incident, a software bill of materials will definitely be a first go-to item in terms of the information that's there that we know someone would have exploited with regards to the software that is infiltrated into your system and is being used as a threat vector at that point.
But reading the software bill of materials itself won't tell you the vulnerabilities unless you have some other source of information about, oh, guess what? That piece of open source that's buried in there, and it's always buried in there, is vulnerable according to this database?
Correct. So that's where it's really important for you to understand what's in your own network and have your own asset management, and then do that comparison and contrast between what vulnerabilities are there and what vulnerabilities you need to make sure are going to be addressed. It's almost like a recall on a part for an auto part. It's great that we're having recalls with regards to a certain set of windshield wipers, but if those windshield wipers aren't on your car, they're not going to necessarily be needed for you to worry about. But it is certainly something to be keeping aware of to make sure that that balance is there. Asset management is going to be the key to all of these things with regards to software supply chain security.
Is there any metric or industry standard? I mean, most packaged software, my understanding is that increasingly it is made up of mostly open source components and somehow tied together by the vendor coder, you know, whatever coding they need to do to make it integrated into a package. But mostly it's the reuse and reconfiguration of open source materials. Fair way to characterize it?
Absolutely. I think almost 80 to 90% of software being used right now does have some level of open source components. But that's why I think the NIST as well as CISA are working with industry to ensure that we can develop software bill of materials that are, number one, done correctly, but number two, usable, and that can be used across the board, whether you're in industry, whether in the federal government, or whether you're in academia. Using those at a normal standard will certainly be something that that software bill of materials will be beneficial for once that standard comes into play. And I believe CISA and NIST are working diligently on that with industry partners.
Jeanette McMillan is Director of the Supply Chain and Cyber Directorate at the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. We'll return with more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Tamman.
Rancher Government Solutions, the leader for securing Kubernetes and cloud-native containerized applications for the U.S. government, has launched Rancher Government Carbide, a revolutionary supply chain security solution in response to the increasing threat to the nation's software supply chain. Carbide simplifies Kubernetes security management by providing a better, more standardized way for users to verify and validate that their software is safe and secure. To learn more, visit ranchergovernment.com.
Welcome back to our interview with Jeanette McMillan, Director of the Supply Chain and Cyber Directorate at the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. We are discussing software bills of material and the software supply chain security issue generally. And maybe just describe for us what happens in the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, who deals with SBOMs. First of all, how do you get them from vendors? Simply include it in the contract, and then what happens to it and what form does it take? Maybe give us a sense of how you operationalize dealing with SBOMs.
Yeah. Well, certainly the SBOMs can be requested. They are not necessarily placed into every single contract. So that would be one of the first things that we would recommend that organizations do. They can certainly request an SBOM. If an SBOM is available, it can be provided. And then what you can do is make sure that that is part of your internal database so that you can constantly make sure that you're checking it and revising it as software updates come about. Again, software as SBOM is not as good as it starts, but it's got to be updated along the life cycle. And that's exactly what we encourage departments and agencies to do. Because once you have that piece of software in, you've got a 1.0, you've got a 2.0, you've got a 3.0. 2.0 has the vulnerability in it that needs to be patched. You want to make sure that you've got that and that your IT as well as your CISO understands where those vulnerabilities are and can make sure that those things are patched accordingly. And that's one of the best practices that we have here in terms of incorporating what we call a cyber supply chain risk management program into your overarching enterprise risk management programs.
How big is a software bill of material? Is it petabytes? Is it terabytes? Is it fit on a keychain drive? And when you open it, what do you see? That is to say, how do you compare it to a vulnerability database?
Yeah, it's several lines of code, and it's very, very challenging to even look to see exactly how you distill that down to what can be usable to someone on the other end. Someone who's not necessarily practiced in code may not be able to find it readily usable, and others need that kind of English translation, if you will, to understand exactly what that means in terms of the code base. But you certainly want to have both so that your network defenders can understand and identify those vulnerabilities in the code, but also that your policy folks can understand exactly what those vulnerabilities are and make sure that you're making the right policies to ensure that people are updating accordingly and can have that information at the ready.
And who does all of this? Is it the CIO function? Is it the contracting officer's representative? I mean, there's a lot of people in the chain of buying to using that expertise could lie at. Where does it, you know, for your organization?
Yeah, we definitely encourage people to develop what we call a C-suite senior leadership team that encourages everyone from your CISO to your CIO to your legal to your policy to your security, as well as those folks that are in acquisition. They're kind of at the thorny end of the stick there. They're the last ditch effort in terms of making sure what you're bringing into the environment is secure and is coming in packaged and as intended. So having everyone on that programmatic and at that C-suite level is clearly important to ensuring that you have the information you need to make the risk determination. Is there a need for us to revise that particular piece of software, or more importantly, exclude that piece of software from our environment? And those are all risk decisions that are going to need to be made at that particular level of implementation and also update.
And getting back to that open source question in this context, there are lots of open source things. There could be a Linux in there somewhere. There could be a Drupal distribution. There's all these different functions, you know, that have open source origins. Could be printer utilities. Nobody wants to code those from scratch anymore, or APIs, this kind of thing. Those could all be open source, but in the particular package for which you have the SBOM, those things are tied together with coding. And does that show up in the SBOM such that you know, is it tied together in a secure way, even though we can maybe verify each of the open source components? Almost
right.
Like a car has to add up to a safe thing, even if it's made of some common components.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things of having those software bill of materials at the ready so that organizations and your IT professionals and especially your network defenders who are looking at the vulnerabilities that are coming across the screen can quickly identify those areas of that package that need to be unpacked. So if you have that list in front of you and you're able to look at those things and ensure that those organizations that need to respond quickly can do so readily and make sure that they can address a patch or a vulnerability. I mean, most organizations don't realize, but it's about 10 days, 5 to 10 days for an attacker to exploit a vulnerability. To patch it, average 60 to 150 days. So in that time frame, anything that an organization can use to reduce the time frame from infiltration compromise to recovery is going to be absolutely key on that. And that's exactly what a software bill of materials will assist in doing. Again, not a silver bullet, but definitely a good start.
It seems like this is an opportunity for shared services. If more than one agency is using a software as a service package from a cloud provider or software as a service provider, or if two people are using the same set of cloud services, I mean, that's software also, really, and should have an SBOM. Can there be some consolidation of this work and say, hey, we're both using this XYZ cloud, and we're both using this set of those commercial cloud services? Let's get together on the SBOM.
Right. I think that's exactly where CISA is trying to go with regards to some of the work it's doing with the Federal Acquisition Security Council, which was a council that was developed a few years ago under the Secure Technology Act. And to your point, one of those things was that for the federal cyber supply chain, which includes all of our software, how can we better share information with regards to what we're using, how we're using it, and most importantly, if there are vulnerabilities there. Whether or not a nation state actor is exploiting those vulnerabilities, understanding where those vulnerabilities are across the supply chain for the federal cyber supply chain is absolutely critical to some of our most important missions. All the critical infrastructure sectors, all of that information is definitely something where we could come together to share more information about how to patch, how to mitigate, and how to get some more secure software in those critical mission areas.
And do you sense that the software industry is becoming more willing to ship the SBOM along with the package itself, given all of this government now is 2 years into this SBOM kind of directive?
Correct. There's definitely a lot more willingness in terms of understanding what the requirements will be. And again, having the opportunity to help shape those things is certainly something that I think industry is definitely keen on, working with, again, CISA and NIST on those requirements. But at this particular point in time, there's not been a set solution all just yet, but they are certainly working towards that, because inevitably this is something that I think all folks will definitely appreciate, from federal government, state, local, private sector, academia. This is certainly additional information that we could all benefit from.
A lot of people talk about wanting to know software provenance, and that's different from knowing the software content. And how does provenance figure into all of this?
Well, provenance definitely allows someone to understand exactly where things came from in the software development life cycle. How did the software evolve? Was it always supposed to be an antivirus software, or did it come with other components? And lo and behold, it does something else unique and beneficial to a particular organization. That's great to know, but if you don't know exactly where the origins came from, some of the software might be used in a way that was never intended. And that's precisely why we believe that the software provenance is something that's good to know, but at the end of the day, what's actually in the software that's being delivered is something that'll give people a leg up when they're trying to respond to incidents.
You wouldn't want your Kubernetes distribution to have been value added in China, for example.
For example, yes.
That might be, that could be a tough one. And a final question about small business. A lot of them do coding, or they are resellers in some way, or value-added resellers. And if you are reselling software, where does the software bill of materials obtaining come into that whole transaction?
Yeah, I think that's something that we're going to try to distribute, especially with regards to small businesses. But if you are in that supplier supply chain area, those three stakeholders, users, suppliers, and developers, if you're in that supplier bucket, there's definitely going to be some interesting outcomes for you because of your liaison relationship between the user and the developer. So that's where I think small businesses that are doing reselling and everything else are going to need to understand exactly what those security requirements are for the users, and then also what the developers can bring to the table as they're trying to push those things forward, and especially with regards to developing that SBOM.
So there's really no shortcuts around any of this, is there?
Not really. But security is never short, and there's always an opportunity to be more secure.
And before we let you go, tell us about Supply Chain Security Month. You've got some special activities going on now.
Yes, thank you so much for that, Tom. Yes, Supply Chain Integrity Month is every April. It is a national event, and NCSC leads this with our federal partners over at CISA, DOD, DCSA, FBI. We certainly want to make sure that people are aware of the supply chain security issues out there, especially the software supply chain security issues that we discussed today. So we really appreciate that. But we certainly wanted to ensure that folks understand that there's a lot of information out there. They can certainly develop their own CSCRM program for their enterprise risk. That's a really, really great way to understand your risk appetite and build a recipe for resilience. And that is indeed our theme for next month, Recipe for Resilience, Supply Chain Security. It's all about you as well. So thank you again for allowing us the time to talk today.
Jeanette McMillan is Director of the Supply Chain and Cyber Directorate at the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. To hear this interview in its entirety or share it with colleagues, please visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights, sponsored by Rancher Government Solutions on Federal News Network.